You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Martin Luther King did not consider rioting an expression of an irrational mob rule. In fact, he considered it an attempt by marginalized people to find their voice and to assert their refusal to be ignored. King referred to a riot as the language of the unheard. Under what circumstances is it all right to circumvent the ballot box and take to the streets? Languages of the Unheard is a new book by Stephen Darcy. It considers the ethics and politics of militant protest and why militant protest is good for democracy. Stephen Darcy is a longtime social activist, as well as an associate professor of philosophy at Huron University College in London, Ontario. And he joins me on the phone this morning from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hi. Yeah.
Good morning and welcome to Red Eye.
Thank you.
Why do people resort to militant protest in the first place?
Well, I guess the main idea of my book is that militant protest is a remedy for a problem that sort of stands in the way of people governing themselves in a democratic manner. And I refer to militancy as a remedial virtue. In other words, something that we admire because it solves a problem that needs to be addressed. And the problem that needs to be addressed is that we have systems of power as well as people in positions of power that are unresponsive to popular grievances or things that people are concerned about and need to be addressed, injustices, exclusions, and so on. So when people have grievances that they want to bring forward and want to have addressed, but they're ignored by systems or people in power, there needs to be a way to a form of civic participation that enables people to address those things. And militancy, you know, essentially militancy is when people decide that if discussion and argumentation is ineffective and institutions are unresponsive, they need to use things like disruption or defiance to ensure that those things get addressed.
Now, rioting is almost always condemned in the media, but in your book, you start by setting out four principles to determine if militancy is consistent with democracy. Can you outline those principles?
Sure. Okay, the first principle I call the opportunity principle, and it essentially says that militancy is justified if it presents an opportunity, a new opportunity, for people to get their grievances addressed when discussion and dialogue and reason-guided public discussion are thwarted by intransigent elites or unresponsive institutions. So if militancy creates an opening for that, or militancy, we admire militancy when it does create an opening or a new opportunity to resolve these grievances, if they're substantive and pressing grievances and they can't be addressed in any other way. That's the opportunity principle. The second is the agency principle, which is that militancy should encourage the most directly affected people to take the lead in securing the resolution of their own grievances. So, in a democratic political process, it's important that people are not having their agency usurped by others. And so that's what the agency principle addresses. The third one is the autonomy principle, that militancy should enhance the power of people to govern themselves through reason-guided public discussion. And the fourth one is the accountability principle, that militancy should limit itself to acts that can be defended publicly as consistent with the common good and common decency.
Now, you also describe different styles of militancy.
Right. Well, there's a number of different styles of militancy. I guess one of them is defiance, which defiance is when people are are challenging authority and refusing to recognize it. For example, rioting is an example of defiance, but so is civil disobedience, where people defy the law. There's other kinds of defiance where people make gestures, I guess symbolic gestures of defiance. For example, the person standing in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square and so on. A second one, I guess, is the disruption. So disruption is when people try to interrupt the operation of systems of power, like by disrupting the way they function and making it impossible for them to function. And a third one is destruction, which is when people damage property or sabotage things or dismantle them. And the fourth one is armed force, where people use, obviously, weapons or, you know, armed force to challenge injustice.
Now, what are some of the standard objections that are presented to counter militancy? What rationalizations does the state usually present to prevent militancy from happening?
Well, you know, the thing, a lot of it has to do with the nature of democracy. I mean, democracy, one thing that I think both militants and their critics tend to agree about is that democracy is importantly about discussion and argumentation. When people try to resolve grievances through discussion, I mean, that's the ideal case, and I think everyone agrees with that, including militant protesters. I mean, militant protesters are often organizing people's assemblies and popular for public forums for discussion, for debate, and so on. And so militants agree with the critics of militancy, who say that discussion is the sort of at the center of democracy. And when people stop discussing, stop arguing, stop reasoning with each other, and start to use force, critics of militancy think that militancy is doing that, and in that way, it's in a sense repudiating democracy and failing to respect democratic norms and values. But what I think critics, the sort of liberal objection, I call it the liberal objection to militancy, that it renounces dialogue in favor of force. What that argument essentially forgets or ignores is the fact that, what militancy is doing is responding in defense of discussion, in defense of dialogue and reason giving, to oppose the operation of powerful people or powerful institutions that are thwarting people in the attempt to resolve their grievances through discussion, right? So the critics of militancy are essentially saying that when people raise grievances through public discussion, and they're ignored by corporations, or they're ignored by politicians and government systems and so on, government structures, that they should just keep on discussing, keep on engaging in dialogue. But what militancy, what makes militancy necessary is not a lack of attachment to dialogue and discussion. It's not a lack of concern for public reasoning and public justification, but an insistence that the institutions and powerful people who thwart discussion by ignoring people or silencing people when they raise grievances, they can't be allowed to win the day. They can't be allowed to win the day. There has to be, if people are going to govern themselves, they have to have a way of defending themselves against powerful systems and powerful people who refuse to let their grievances be taken seriously and addressed and discussed in full. And so militancy is a kind of self-defense of democracy against power, against the powerful who want to ignore what people say and silence them.
Now, I was wondering, one of the case studies you cover in the book is that of Kana Satake from about 20-some-odd years ago. I was wondering can you describe what the events, happened at Kana Satake, and how that fits in with your overall thesis about militancy?
So in 1990, I mean, I guess obviously it's a long story, but I'll try to give the short version. So in 1990, the mayor of a town called Oka in Quebec, near Montreal, decided to encourage the expansion of a 9-hole golf course into an 18-hole golf course just outside the town of Oka. And the land that this was going to happen on had been contested for centuries, actually, because it had been the land was deemed to be their land by the governor of New France, or recognized as indigenous land. But it was placed technically, in the legal sense, I guess, it was placed in trust with some with a Christian religious community, Catholic religious community, which then treated it as their own property, sold it to real estate speculators, and that was how it was treated by this mayor of Oka, who deemed it to be private land, and he wanted to build this golf course. All right, so that's a thumbnail sketch of the context. But when the people of Kanasatake decided to that this was unjust, it was taking away their land, land that they depended on. There was a graveyard that would be threatened, and so on. They first organized a march through the town, which was ignored. They raised the issue with a minister of the Quebec government, who wrote a letter supporting them to the mayor, and that was also ignored. The courts ignored their arguments, and so the construction was about to proceed. And having tried all of these other methods to have their concern addressed, and having been persistently ignored, they decided that they had an opportunity, to refer back to that opportunity principle, they had an opportunity to resolve the problem by using militancy. That is to say, they were going to disrupt the construction project by blocking access to their land. When they did that, however, again, the courts issued an injunction to remove them, and the Quebec provincial police proceeded to try to do so through force with an armed attack. They defended themselves also with weapons, and there was some exchange of gunfire. And although it's there's a dispute about who fired first, there was an exchange of gunfire, and a police officer was killed in the shooting. That led to a siege that lasted for several weeks, and eventually the government, the federal government, purchased the land, and that's sort of the so-called standoff was ended at that point, and they had succeeded in stopping the golf course from being constructed, but of course the land is still in dispute. So to me, the reason this is an important case for me, I refer to it as the model case of militancy, a case where we can understand what we value and admire about sound militancy by looking at this case, because it's an example of how these sort of principles that I mentioned earlier apply in a practical case, and in a sense why we admire them. So the first principle is the opportunity principle. This was a situation where nothing, the grievances were being ignored through all of the methods of discussion and dialogue that were attempted were consistently ignored. But this militant action of disrupting the construction project and defying the injunction enabled people to create a new opportunity to have their grievance addressed when it had been ignored in all of the other ways. Secondly, it was a type of action that enhanced the autonomy of people. I mean, you know, the four principles that I mentioned are really principles of what makes militancy democratic. And in this case, it enhanced the autonomy of the people. These are people whose land base and who the life of their community was really at the mercy of these institutions of the Canadian state that were completely unresponsive to their concerns, values, and priorities, and their needs and interests. But by taking this militant action, they were able to enhance their control over their own lives and community, and take some of that power back that had been usurped by these state institutions. And thirdly, it was the thing that we admire about the Kanasatake case is that not only did it enhance their autonomy, but it respected their agency. which is to say it wasn't a matter of outsiders doing something on their behalf, but the people in the community and others that they invited as allies to support them were making ensuring that this action was carried out in a way that was consistent with their priorities and aims. So it was a case where the people most directly affected were able to take the lead in securing the resolution of the grievance. And then finally, they acted in ways that they could defend publicly, plausibly, and in good faith as consistent with common decency and the common good, which to me is another important part of democratic militancy, because militancy is often undertaken by minorities or sometimes small groups of people, but it has to be defensible in public to large groups of people, and specifically defensible as consistent with the dignity of each and the welfare of all, that you can't just say we're doing this and we don't care whether it's right or wrong or whether this is going to make everyone's lives worse or better, but rather it has to be defensible in a way that people can at least recognize as attempts to publicly justify. You don't have to convince people, but you have to regard yourself as accountable to people. And in particular, in this case, the people most directly affected, so the people in the community were, had the opportunity to ensure that their needs, interests, and dignity were respected. So that's why I see it as a model case, because it exemplifies all of these democratic values that I think help respond to that liberal objection to militancy by pointing out that militancy may be controversial, it may involve a lot of conflict, but it doesn't in any way have to show disrespect for democratic values and principles, but in fact can serve as a key way of defending them.
Well, it's a fascinating book, having read it over the last couple of weeks, and I know we've only just scratched the surface on it, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us about it, Stephen.
Okay, thank you very much.
I've been speaking to Stephen Darcy. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Huron University College in London, Ontario. He's also a longtime social activist and a protest organizer. His new book, Languages of the Unheard, is available now from Between the Lines Books.